I think have been really good and have accomplished a lot, and I, you know, I'm making this critique of things that I've been part of. It's I'm not repudiating them or feeling guilty or anything else. But it's as you move, you have to figure out what's important and what's different and so on. And so I found out as I've gone along about more and more examples of women who've engaged particularly in nonviolent kind of direct action around the world. And I think that even you see this even in seeing some of the ways in which Corazon Aquino is interesting. I mean, she's not any reputed pacifist or anything like that I know of, who knows, but she's done things herself just out of, I think, a basic women's consciousness. You know, that little yellow dress of hers is just shadowy. And I mean, it hardly says I'm the big shot head of state, you know. And yet she has taken her authority. I mean, it's and she's done things like refused the gun salute, you know, where they the whatever, I don't know how many guns they do it with, but you know, the blowing off of the cannon, here comes the chief kahuna, the head of state, you know, we'll shoot all the guns off. So she's refused to do that, and people have tied yellow ribbons around the guns in the Philippines, just out of the sort of, she's engendered that kind of consciousness. And I myself am not sure where the yellow image even comes from exactly, or who or quite what that is.
It's her favorite color.
Okay.
Wow.
It's something else. It's something else too. It's the color sisters sure. of their husband or something.
Yeah, yeah. But it's very personal.
Yeah.
It's something that she
was in Newsweek the other week.
The color he was wearing when he was shot.
Well, what I mean, I don't really know, but it's coming to. It seems to me like potentially. It's coming to mean something else, and it's coming to have a meaning in the Philippines that has this spirit, you know. And she also said on International Women's Day that she was, you know, proud to be the president of the Philippines and so on and so forth, but she was prouder than anything of being a woman and the way that the women had blocked, had, you know, really been a major instrument in keeping the transition nonviolent and in protecting the people who had, you know, blockaded themselves in the ministry so that they weren't killed. And, you know, so it's a sort of unexpected, I mean, it's just kind of interesting. And this is just one example, one particular woman who's done a few things that I think are kind of interesting in imagination. And, you know, the Argentinian, the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo, are well known. I mean, in all kinds of highly repressive situations, women have figured out ways to both represent and resist violence and oppression, and it is born out of necessity. And but I think, you know, even while we may, you know, say that there are situations in the world where people are justified or find themselves as having no recourse to other than to violent struggle, that even in those situations, most of what's going on in so-called revolution is not the shooting of the guns and so on. I mean, it's the educating, the winning of the hearts and minds of people, the making of a different culture and so on. That's just one tiny part of it, even when it's a so-called violent struggle. So this idea that there are violent struggles and nonviolent struggles isn't even exactly right. I mean, you know, a real change comes from those kind of, the nonviolent aspects, even of a violent struggle, a real change in the lives of people and how they meet their needs, grow things, the economy, the culture, all that sort of stuff. And so some of these dichotomies, I think, as feminists have begun to even think about that stuff, things cease to be too polarized. And so I just think that what we need to do, there are actually a lot more examples that I won't go into, but what we need to do is, even without getting balled up in these discussions of whether someone is an absolute pacifist, a provisional pacifist, advocate of nonviolence, whether nonviolence is a tactic, a religion, a philosophy, a way of life, whatever. I mean, I'm actually quite interested in these discussions, and I think they're very important. But I think that there may be ways, you know, as we're having some of these discussions, that I think in keeping with some of the things that Kate was talking about this morning, you know, how do we engender a politics that is really appropriate to our criticism of this society, and where does theory go into practice, even while theory is, you know, people are still thinking about things. I think we can still make, say that our feminist practice, ideally, is a nonviolent practice and an imaginative practice, a practice that empowers the different women in it and has as little differential as possible between leaders and participants and, you know, the different people who take part in something, which values the part of different women. And so it seems to me that those are some of the things that need to characterize our work and an ability to work across race, class, national kind of boundaries in some way that expands our imagination is one of the things that we need to do and one of the directions that we need to be going in. So those are, you know, those are some of the thoughts that I have about feminist actions. And I don't know if people here, other people here have ideas for things, or if you want to talk about, you know, I mean, there are actually some actions that are planned that could be talked about, and there's some different kinds of things going on as well.
I just want to add a footnote to what you were saying, and this is about the Women's Pentagon action. Even though I think when we were organizing it, we saw it really as a regional action, not a large action, we still get letters from all over the world. Women still hear about it, women still might know about it. I mean, I think it had that quality of imagination, I guess maybe outrageousness, whatever, that touched women. And I think it's important to say it and remember it, because whatever future actions we develop, I think we'll have to have that quality to really reach out. Because these letters come in unsolicited. We never saw it as an international action. And in a funny way, it has inspired women in a lot of places.
Yeah, and it's also an action which was really very small in numbers. I mean, you know, we've had this discussion that I think the first one was 2,000, the second one may have been 4,000. And we're not talking here about a mass action. We're talking about a particular kind of act, you know, organized on a fairly short-term basis, which had a certain quality to it, you know, and that those are the kind of actions that, you know, they're things that don't have to involve, in other words, huge, gigantic, hundreds of thousands of people.
That would be nice.
Yes, we're not against it.
The first one, no.
Right. Your first step, but your second one has to involve hundreds of thousands.
Well, don't you think, too, that what you were saying about women empowering women, that if women are really going to grow and if the peace movement is really going to grow, we have to learn how to empower those people that disagree with us, too. You know, I mean, that coalition building. Listening to Holly Neer this fall in Washington was that she said that you know when you're doing coalition work when you're threatened to the very core to talk to the person that you disagree with most. But it was her feeling then, and I think she made a real important point, was that the kind of thing that really changes people is not only can you empower people who are like you, but if you can help to empower people who are dislike, you know, who have entirely different views, that's where the whole idea of peace is going to come, because you have an understanding between two people. But the thing that she found, she said, is that the only way you'll know if you do that is if you're just so scared and so threatened by even associating with those people. And that seems to be what you were saying happened in the peace tent. You know, there's always had to be something to keep the tension down. But when you're really doing coalition building, that's the type of...
Well, you could call it coalition building, but it's also sisterhood. It's right, solidarity.
Sisterhood,
it's
right.
Human understanding. You
right.
know, it's not... Coalition building seems to have some purpose in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whereas
yeah.
sisterhood is just more absolutely, just that's it.
Yeah.
Could I suggest, we did, other thing that I didn't mention was the rituals that we did in the peace tent. And that was also, you know, that was also sort of hard to do. And yet we did it, and it worked out just beautifully. And so I was going to suggest that we could do one here before we break up. And I was going to connect it to that. I would suggest doing two or three things. One is, I'd like to teach you a song. I'd like for us to hold hands and make sound. I don't know if you all are used to doing that. Very lovely thing to do. Just start out then. I say we set a tone. Setting a tone. You just go, does it have any tone that you require?
I'm a sister.
Come in.
Oh, hello.
Welcome.
We're just singing to you. She's hearing on the tower.
At the Soviet American Dialogue, I had this rainbow thread which I brought with me, and I had been trying to resolve a personal problem by untangling this thread, you know, metaphorically kept on trying to untangle it. And so I just turned from the personal problem to the political, and I gave it to the Soviet and American women and said, unravel the problem, you know. And they, during the dialogue, they sat there and were working on unraveling this thread. You can just imagine how different from the UN that was. And later, I used the thread again. Oh, and when they did decide on doing something together, they decided on doing a simultaneous peace action. The two long pieces of the thread came untangled right at that moment, which, you know, was just magic. Anyhow, so I've been cut off little pieces of this thread and gave it to people as sign of feminist bonds. And I'm almost out. But I've got a little piece here that's tied around a blank room, which stands for trust. So I'll just pass it around and you all can look at it and just pass it around. And meanwhile, I'd like to teach you a song that's familiar already, which goes, building bridges between our divisions, I reach out to you and you reach out to me. With all of our voices and all of our visions, sisters, we can make such a sweet harmony. Y'all, okay, it goes, building bridges between our divisions. I reach out to you and you reach out to me. With all of our voices and all of our visions, sisters, we can make such a sweet harmony. Building bridges between our divisions, I reach out to you and you reach out to me. With all of our voices and all of our visions, sisters, we can make such a sweet harmony. It's always, when you're doing rituals, always do what you say, like, I reach out to you and you reach out to me and say, you have to do it. Otherwise, you're doing a contradiction there.
Building bridges between our divisions, I reach out to you and you reach out to me.
We can add this to this passing around this room. I did one where we were passing around the heart. We had a little heart, and we would think the circulation of the heart. And we would think about the person that's holding it at the time to pass it around. So we could add that. If you do it fairly quickly, though, we'll just think about, have that person in your consciousness as she's holding that.
Kind of organizers love it, but we also pass around them.
Okay.
I was just thinking that.
That's a time-honored ritual.
I'll hear it.
Well, I want to add that last year, when I was in Bethesda, I had been working with a Chilean group. They were like closer in language, you know, but still I don't manage perfectly. But anyway, it was a great experience for me to be in a women's group that was not from my country. And now, even though, even though this is occasionally meeting, say it's a group, but it's a group of women. Anyway, I feel happy to be with you, and to know as your name.
And Esther.
And Esther, or all the other persons who has talked here, has expressed that there is a common feeling about the women in the field of other events that we could have in particular.
Yes.
Thank you to be with me.
Then you brought out a point earlier too how poverty and violence, or how the violence of poverty can also affect peace issues. And thinking about how people can get involved. I mean, even just helping. I mean, not that we're not in our own poverty, so we have to go help people that are in poverty. But I mean, our daily assistance in learning from other people is a way of fostering peace. That you said that I thought was an important
point. And one thing I think, what you're saying seems to me to be very important, because I think we need to really understand. I don't know quite how this became anti-nuclear politics, and why I didn't say peace politics, because that's really too narrow. I mean, we really wanted to talk feminist politics and feminist peace politics, really. And they do have to do with development, poverty, ecology, racism, and a whole series of other things. You know, it's not that easy to figure out how you keep all these things in your consciousness and going at the same time. But I think we really have got to really be able to do that and to develop a kind of way of articulating our politics and theory and a whole, so this kind of ongoing process of really educating ourselves and moving our thinking and developing all kinds of ways of representing our politics. You know, from writing to, action to ritual to just theater to art to everything that you can imagine, to making, to consistently saying that we're not going to have a fragmented kind of politics, and to have, say, to see issues as one discrete from another. I mean, the violence of, not feeding of refugees, of starvation, of food, all those things are really connected to the violence of, in Central America, to the nuclear weapons, to all these different kinds of things. I mean, you can't separate the economic priorities from the weapons and all that sort of stuff. And if that kind of idea could get out there, then that seems to me to be really a much, what feminist peace politics are about. And if that's where we really need to really get that into the public world. I also think that that would make the range of people who are part of the feminist peace movement much greater. If the real concerns of the women of the world are represented in those politics, all of them. And that was one thing that was inspiring about Nairobi. I mean, the equality, peace, and development, and the kind of way that people try to relate those things, not necessarily, but all those things were seen as connected, and I think really have to be part of our peace politics. And that was really something, that was something that I learned from that, and I think we just still have to figure out ways that we're making those connections very real.
There is going to be a UN conference this summer in Paris on the connections between disarmament and development. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting that kind of connection is made sort of the year after the women's conference, because I really do feel like that was the first time I heard those connections made. So it'd be interesting to see what they come up with this summer, and who's there, and what happens, how it's important.
That we have to
figure out ways that we use power, techniques that we actually have in order to make change. And one thing that women do have now that they haven't had in the past is great economic power.
No, we don't.
Well, a lot more than we used to. A lot more than we used to. For instance, consider what would happen if all women who feel the way we do here today stopped paying taxes. Now, this government is very concerned, first of all, because we're a capitalist society, very concerned with who makes money and how much of it the government gets and so on, but also very concerned with lowering the deficit, getting rid of this problem that we have with debt in this country. What would happen if all women who felt this way stopped paying their taxes?
I think there is a women's tax resistance group.
No, but I mean, as an action, not as a permanent thing. Obviously, you can't stop paying your taxes, but as an action to show this is how much power we have and this is what we can do with it.
You can stop paying your taxes. I don't pay my taxes. I don't pay a percentage of my taxes that
you need
to
organize
the military as much,
right, yeah. As an organized form of protest,
oh, yeah.
Which would last, say, for X amount of time, and then after that, there would be some further action. In other words, some dialogue would develop, obviously, between the government and this group, because you can't have people not paying your taxes. But that's just an...
People
just throwing
who
that
are
out.
Interested in war tax resistance should write the War Resisters League. There's a guide on war tax resistance. There are a lot of examples of women, like Juanita Nelson, who have, in one way or another, decided to pull out of that, either in a permanent way or in a symbolic way. So that is a whole
I think there is a case to be made also for the women who have money even if they don't control it. And there's a lot of, they say, a lot of fortunes in the United States owned by women who don't control them. I believe that, going back to your moral code point, you know, I still think of it as different value systems, and that women have an altruistic value system. Because we have to bring up kids, and we
exactly.
have to think about the other person.
Exactly.
And while men have a more egotistical one, and that happens even with women who have money, and they have to be that, or they're not even considered women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're considered following, you know, being male and so on. And women that do have money, I really believe that feminism is cross-class. And they could very well support women's things, these things.
Sure, there's a perfect example. The new Women's Museum in Washington was founded by a woman who has a fortune. And she became an art collector, as many wealthy women do. But she wanted to collect women paintings by women, and that's what she did. And she, by God, is founding the Museum for Women in the Arts in Washington. They just bought a whole building 3 blocks from the White House.
Unleash this altruism from the
exactly. There's no reason why you can't have an altruistic
or
institution. You just make it, take it up to a bigger level. You know, you can still think about other people. You just do it on a grand scale instead of at your home.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask if there are people here who would like me to write on the board some of the books that are around about
women.
Please, yes. I made up a list of them what did you say?
The Women's Pentagon actually, is there an essay or book about that? I've never read anything about that.
There's something that's available in an issue of Socialist Review that was in 1981, I guess, by Michelle Lim and Rhoda Linton. And there's also an interview in that same issue with Donna Warnock, which I think is really pretty good. I mean, I wrote a response that's in the issue after this, but what I don't think is pretty good about it, but mostly I think it's really pretty good.
What was the citation?
The Socialist Review, and it's a late, it's, I think it's November, December, 80, it's got to be 82, because it was written about the second one. I think it's 82. It's in 82 somewhere. There's that. And the other thing that I wanted to mention to people before we broke up is that the Center for Women's Empowerment is still in existence. I mean, those of you who may remember that, you know, years ago, we decided to start peace camps. Some people have been involved in the Women's Pinnacle in Action. People were in different kinds of networks. And what we did, because of the difference between the situation here and in England and the fact that there is a common law and wanting to be accessible, we pooled our resources and bought this farm that adjoins the public Seneca. And so it's continued to be a women's community and a scene for staging actions. And sometimes there are very few people there, 3 or 4, and sometimes there have been hundreds. And it's tended to be closed and the activity to be fairly low during the winter. But in the summer, this summer they're planning an action around, I believe, the date's August 5th, early August. The theme of the action is the declaration of interdependence, which is, you know, sort of in keeping with the what we were talking about, you know, the kind of politics we're trying to create. And this action is being coordinated, you know, it's a series of things, and y'all can get in touch with them and Romulus, there's an action that's being held here at the Statue of Liberty. I mean, I don't know. Grace, do you know enough about that to say something about it?
It's being organized by a group of women who they've had 2 different names at the time. One is called Women Rising and the other is called Grassroots Women. And they're women who originally were women who chained themselves to the Illinois. Remember when they were going at the ERA? And, you know, so they're Illinois women out of Champaign, and they're organizing from that distance, which makes it hard, you know, an action on August 3rd at the Statue of Liberty, and they have boats and stuff like that which you need to get to the statue. And they are planning the theme sort of is one in which the statue, the women take back the statue, take her back and then take her torch and shine it on all our problems. You know, and that's a sort of nice way of bringing you all together. I would write to them in Urbana, but I actually think we'll probably hear about it very soon, and there probably will be information right here at Barnard on what they're doing. I don't have the address.
What's the name of that group?
Well, I think they now call themselves Grassroots Women.
And by virtue of being here, you can find your way onto various mailing lists about a sundry events, educational forums, conferences, peace tents, action.
Well, this is I think this mailing list, you know, will sort of take responsibility
to get
seen to
you
to it that you find out about these reactions.
I don't know if anyone mentioned there's something called Agenda, which covers the women's activities in the Columbia and Barnard area. It includes women at the law school. There's an all-day law, women in law conference coming up in April. It comes through the Columbia Women's Center. They're now both the Columbia and Barnard Women's Center. They reach out through the people more at Columbia than the number. There's also in this area, the influence rich woman it's a liturgy group that is writing its own faith statements. So if you're interested in transforming spiritual language, faith and beliefs into experience, that process is there's also something called Mother Thunder Mission in the 40s on the west side, which is working with what's called inclusive language liturgy, an attempt to bring feminine language about the divine or highest values into a liturgical process.
And also, really, there is a, I'm sorry. You know, there's really, I mean, truthfully, it seems that there should be a feminist piece, you know, newsletter or publication. There really isn't one. So what you have to do, I mean, there should be, and probably at some point will be, but, you know, that would inform people about events and books and conferences and educational stuff, and, you know, help do with the networking. Because I think one of the strengths of the movement has been the decentralized affinity group, consciousness-raising, like, structures, you know. On the other hand, those things don't necessarily, you know, it's hard, you can be not knowing what other people are doing very easily. I mean, you know, that's the advantage of having a big national organization or something. So what you have to do is kind of really take some real initiative and avail yourself of different places and really look. But, you know, there's an awful lot going on.
I was just going to once again mention Monday, 1:30 in the street, the demonstration against the testing. And there's also going to be a civil disobedience at the U.S. missions sometime around Monday, 1:30, gathering in Ralph Bunch Park and walking and having a vigil. The other thing is that a few people, as we went around, talked about an interest in nonviolence training. I'm a nonviolence trainer. If people are interested in that, you should just let me know. And I'll just put a star in the YouTube.
Is that like conflict resolution type of stuff?
Some of it is, but it's also training for civil disobedience, particularly in sort of the issues that come up.
I want to mention once again, it's so interesting the connection between issues and how it comes up in coincidence, because Monday is the anniversary of Archbishop Romero's death.
Mm-hmm.
He's the Salvadorian.
There's a service being held Monday.
There's been so many horrors perpetrated on the world's people, and also so many incidences of uprising by people against that death. Mm-hmm. Almost any day is the anniversary of something.
That's right. Yesterday was Sharpeville, today is the Passover laws. Yeah. Monday goes on like that.
Yeah.
I'm going to turn this machine off.
Did anybody?